Do you feel different? So I remember the first time Lama Yeshe taught that meditation, it was in Switzerland, many years ago. Can't even remember when, maybe the late 70s or very early 80s, right before he passed away. It's quite a powerful meditation. I've taught it several times when I do prison visits, and they love it. So I think it's quite a potent thing. It just gives us the time to slow down and contemplate a little bit, to focus our mind on, you know, the visualization and also on the sound of the syllables. And when we're imagining the light coming, it's just that, imagination. Don't think that you're doing it wrong if you don't see light, okay? So don't try and see anything in the way that you see things with your eyes, but rather this is done on the level of mental image, okay? So do you have any questions about it?
Is this one that you would do with the purification
meditations? Okay. So the question was, is this a meditation that you would do with purification in the evening? The answer is yes. It's a good one to do then. So if you used it as part of your purification practice, then at the beginning of the meditation, it would be good to do a little bit of a review about what you did all day and think of things in particular that maybe you don't feel so good about what you did or what you said or what you thought or what you felt. And instead of hanging on to that and going to sleep with all that weightiness in your heart, then just, you know, actively confess it, open it up, you know, and kind of express that regret to the Buddha. And then do the purification of the white, red, and blue coming and purifying. And make some kind of determination to try and avoid that behavior, those kind of thoughts again in the future. And feel like the light gives you the strength, the internal strength, to be able to do that. Yeah. So it's good to do in the evening as part of your purification. Or if you want to, you could also do it in the morning. Like as you're getting ready for the day's activities, if something's going to be happening that day that you have some apprehension about, you know, you're going to be having a meeting with somebody, you're not sure how it's going to turn out or whatever, then do it in the morning and imagine that as the light comes, it, just relaxes your whole body and mind. Know, and gives you confidence so that when you go out into the day's activities, you're going forth, you know, feeling like you've been cleansed, like your good qualities have been watered and fertilized, and like you can take them out into the day with you. And so it's good to do like that also in the morning if you want to.
Mm-hmm. The colors, what's the symbolic?
The symbolic meaning of the colors?
I thought Buddha must be an American guy.
Well, no, it's not because the Buddha was, you know, so patriotic with red, white, and blue. Okay. I'm not sure why white is associated with the body or red with speech or blue with the mind. But again and again, this is what happens. And I'm not sure why it isn't another color. Often you talk of three Buddha families, you know, Vairochana and Amitabha and Akshobhya, at your heart. Okay, and so Vairochana is white, at your brow, and Amitabha is red at your heart, and Akshobhya is, I'm sorry, red at your throat, and Akshobhya is blue at your heart. So it may have something to do with those three Buddhas, but beyond that, I don't know. Okay. Then again and again, you find, you know, those three syllables associated, you know, Om at the brow, Ah at the throat, and Hu at the heart. You know, that comes in many, many practices. You find that. Okay. So there's something very nice about working with symbolism in this way, with colors and symbolism and just the imagination. Because on one hand, while it's very important to do the analytic meditations on Lam Rim and really think about the teachings and probe them, it's also important to work in this way with, you know, symbolism, colors, mantra, in another way to help relax the mind. And it can also, when you do that, you can bring what you've understood in your analytical meditations into your visualization, in the sense that when the white, red, and blue light are coming, you can think that all the hindrances to understanding the different themes that you're doing analytical meditation on, that all those hindrances are being purified, and that all the inspiration from all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to actually realize those topics that you're doing the analytical meditation on, that all their inspiration is flowing into you. And so then afterwards, when you, let's say, you know, meditate on precious human life or death or refuge or karma or any of the bodhicitta meditations or something like that, you feel like you've already been purified, you've already been inspired, and so then kind of your analytic meditation becomes much clearer. Okay. Any other questions about that? Yeah?
For me, it's very difficult to, analytical meditation is probably easier than just the visualization aspect. And I think it's probably just a person-to-person different. Some people have just been doing a lot of visualization.
Yeah, okay, so he's saying that for him, the analytic meditation of the Lam Rim is easier. And for other people, I bet you the visualization is easier. Yeah. So people have different dispositions, different tendencies, and that's fine. Yeah. And you can go with what is easier for you, but it's also good to do the one that isn't easier for you too. Okay. An important thing when you're doing the analytic meditations, which is Holiness the Dalai Lama really stresses the importance of those, is don't make them just purely intellectual. Don't kind of like be, you know, giving a lecture or something, but really try and apply the meaning of those teachings to your own life. And as you go through the various points of the meditation, really think about them in terms of your own life and how your own mind works. And so for some people who, you know, work a lot with words, doing that kind of meditation, you know, it's much easier for them. They can concentrate better. They can bring about a quite a strong feeling. Yeah. Then other people, just working with the colors and the mantras, the visualization aspect, that's easier for them. That's fine. Yeah. But it's good to do both. Yeah, so that we're able to develop all the various capacities of our mind.
This is the mind center?
Yeah, the center of our chest is the mind center.
Oh, could you speak about that?
Okay, yeah, so they often talk of three chakras, you know, one at our brow, the throat and speech, makes sense. The mind at the heart, the center of the chest, because you know when you have a very strong emotion, you often feel it right here, don't you? When people say, "I was really touched by somebody," what somebody said, they go, "I was really touched." They don't go, "I was really touched," do they? You know, or they don't touch their knee to say, "I was really touched." They touch here and they say, You know, or when you somebody does something very kind, you go thank you very much, and you put your hand, you know, in the center of your chest. So, you know, we naturally associate that with kind of the mind or the heart. Also, when they talk about the death process and what happens as our physical body becomes unable to support our mind and act as a physical basis for the mind, then they talk about how the consciousness is slowly, slowly dissolving into the heart, and all this subtle energy or the chi that the consciousness rides on is slowly dissolving into the heart center. Yeah. And so it's from there that the extremely subtle mind departs and goes into the intermediate or bardo stage. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. Since your mind is here, is this your mind stream also?
Okay, so if your mind is at your heart, is that your mind stream?
Yeah, mind stream doesn't have a place.
Yeah, mind stream doesn't really have a place, and it's not saying that your mind is at your heart. You know, because your mind is just vaguely with your body and, you know, in all places. When we say mind stream, it's not something that's different than mind, okay? But mind stream is emphasizing that the mind is a continuity, that it's not a fixed thing, okay? It's a stream.
And the mind is just one part of that.
No, mind is, it's like, how could you say? You could say Mississippi, and you can say Mississippi River. And it's kind of the same, you know. People might get when you say Mississippi that you're talking about the river. You know, the river implies a continuity, doesn't it? So your mind is not separate from your mind stream. It's just what aspect is being emphasized when you use one word rather than the other word. And when we talk about mind, we're not just talking about intellect, okay? We're talking about all of the cognitive processes that we have, be it our sense consciousnesses that function or our mental consciousness that thinks, and our various emotions, all the cognitions that we have, okay, all the perceptions. So all of those are included. The thing that is perceiving or cognizing or experiencing or feeling or emoting or thinking, all of that is included in the word mind. And, you know, the mind isn't one thing, is it? Because there's many different types of mind, many different qualities of mind. It's like bottled water isn't one thing. There's many different types of bottled water. Yeah, but we use bottled water as a general name to include many different types. So we use the word mind to include many different mental states. Okay, is that clear now? Okay. Anything else about that? The mind is also different from the brain. The brain's the physical organ. The mind is what perceives. And if you ever want to make a scientist feel nervous, ask him what the mind is. You know? And they get really, you know, they can tell you about the brain, but the mind just is not so clear to a scientist. Okay? And that's because the mind is not something that can be measured with scientific instruments, because the mind is not made out of atoms and molecules. The basic qualities of mind are called clarity and awareness. Okay, those are the two traits upon which we merely label mind. So clarity, you know, one meaning of clarity is that it's not made of atoms and molecules, it's without form. Another meaning of clarity is that the mind has the ability to reflect objects. Yeah. And then awareness has the meaning of being able to engage with those objects. So not just reflecting the objects the way a mirror reflects an object, but actually a mind is able to engage with an object. Yeah? And so there's cognition going on there. There's feeling, there's experience. In dependence upon the body and mind being associated, then we label person or I or whatever somebody's name is. Okay? So actually this can be very helpful for when you're meditating on emptiness, to see that any word you use is actually something that refers to a collection of various things. Yeah. So the word I, you know, is given independence upon the collection of body and mind. The word mind is labeled independence upon the collection of different kinds of consciousness. You know, upon the collection of the qualities of clarity and awareness. The word body is labeled in dependence upon an accumulation of atoms and molecules arranged in a certain form. Yeah. And so we begin to see here how things exist by being merely labeled in dependence upon a basis of labeling or basis of designation. Yeah. And so the basis of designation is never one findable, solid thing. It's always a collection of different attributes, different parts, but we give it one label, and then we treat it as if it were one thing. But in actual fact, it's, you know, it's one thing that exists in dependence upon a bunch of other things, and that is not findable either in those things that it depends on or separate from those things it depends on. Okay? Is that challenging you a little bit? Yeah? Yeah? Because just as, you know, we say I and we feel I, you know, there's me sitting here, there's a real solid me. Well, actually, what we call me exists, you know, in dependence upon a body and mind in a relationship, and then the label me being given to it. And then we say body, you know, and we think of body as one big thing, don't we? One thing, you know, my body, one thing. But actually, the body's a collection of all different parts, isn't it? And if you look in all the parts to find a body, can you find a body? You know, if you look, is your little finger your body? Or this finger? You know, this is why we learn, you know, little, what is it, little piggy went to market, little piggy went home. You know, you start looking through all your little, all your fingers, all the things, saying, is this the body? Is this the body? Is this the body? Is this, you know, you go through all your body parts. You can't say that any of them in and of themselves are the body, or is the body, okay? But on the other hand, is the body something separate from all the body parts? No, you can't find a body separate from the body parts. Can you find a body in the body parts? No. Where can you find a body? Nowhere. Does that mean the body doesn't exist? No, it exists. Our bodies are here, sitting in this room. Okay, so what we're getting at is that while things are not findable, when you search for them, when you try and look for something and pinpoint exactly what it is, you can't find it, okay? That is ultimate analysis, so it means ultimately something is empty of inherent existence. But conventionally, on the level of appearances, things appear, our body appears, and our body functions. Remember last night we were talking about ultimate truths and conventional truths? This is it. Okay. So similar, we say mind. Okay, my mind. We might think of mind as, you know, one solid thing. But when we start to examine, well, what is mind? No. Is it the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness? No. Nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness? Mental consciousness, what is the mind? Is it the emotion of anger, the emotion of peacefulness, yeah, the emotion of regret, the emotion of, you know, joy? What is it? What is the mind? Yeah, we can't identify any particular mental state or any particular cognizer and say this is mind. And only this is mind and nothing else is mind. We can't do that. But we can't also find the mind separate from all those different kinds of mental states or cognizers, can we? Okay. So the mind exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon all those mental states and types of cognizers. So the mind is empty of inherent existence. On an ultimate level, you can't find it. But conventionally, on the level of appearances, we can talk about the mind and it functions and it does things. Okay? But you can't, you know, you can't, when you search for it with this ultimate analysis, you can't find it, but it can still exist on a conventional level. Okay? So that's a very important thing to distinguish, especially when you're meditating on emptiness, that something can be unfindable on an ultimate level, but exist on a conventional level. Yeah, and that those two things are not contradictory. You know, something being empty of inherent existence, yet being conventionally existent as a dependent arising, that those two things come to the same point and they complement each other. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that just because you give something a label, you make it exist. Now, the famous things in the scriptures are a rabbit's horn. Yeah, we can, you know, you see a bunny from a distance and you don't see very clearly and you think the rabbit has horns. Or a turtle's mustache. That's a good one, isn't it? Or a flower in the sky. So we, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Okay, there are certain things that are just not existent. Yeah, and they don't exist conventionally, and they don't exist ultimately. Okay, but that's different, you know, because those things, you can investigate conventionally and you find that they aren't there. Okay. Yeah. Whereas, you know, a person or a body or a mind, you can look for it on the conventional level and you can say, you know, Jim is over there and, you know, Sharon is over here. Yeah. So you can, you know, conventionally locate a person or you can say, you know, there's a body or there's a bottle of water, there's a clock. Okay, but that's, you know, on the conventional level, not the ultimate level.
So does anything exist on the ultimate level?
Does anything exist on the ultimate level? No. Okay, on the ultimate level, you can't find anything. So even emptiness is empty. Okay. Emptiness does not ultimately exist. It does not exist on the ultimate level because anything that exists on the ultimate level, we should be able to find and draw a line around it and say this and only this is it, independent of all things. But remember yesterday when we were talking about emptiness, we saw that even emptiness was dependent. Okay? It depended on the conventional object that existed that it was the emptiness of. Okay? So everything exists dependently. There's no absolute truth out there that's isolated, that's independent from anything else in the universe. Everything exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon other factors that are not it. Yeah? Okay.
That's why nothing exists on the ultimate level is simply because you can't draw a big enough circle.
Well, no. It's not that you can't draw a big enough circle. You can't draw any circle. Okay? Because if I were to say, if I were to look, let's say, for myself on the ultimate level, what am I going to draw a circle around and say, this is me? Well, could I say I'm the whole universe? Am I a star out there in space? No, I'm not a star out in space. Yeah, because the star, I perform a different function than the star performs.
Okay, but even, I'm having a little trouble getting from the conventional level to the ultimate level here.
Okay.
Make this transfer.
Uh-huh.
You're saying that you exist on the conventional level, mm-hmm. I exist on the conventional level.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go to the ultimate level, we have to include all of the things that we're dependent on.
Ah, when we go to the, say that you said on the conventional level?
We have a collection of parts that
uh-huh.
can label.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
The water bottle, you, the lamp, the television.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go to the ultimate level, then we start, we can't find these things because we're including all the things that they're dependent upon. Is that what I heard you say?
Okay. We can't find the things when we examine on an ultimate level, okay? Because we can't find something that is ultimately the referent of the term that we're using. Okay? So if we say clock, okay, we can investigate in this whole accumulation of parts right here and try and find a clock, and we can't find one thing that is the clock. Okay, that doesn't mean, okay, the clock, put it this way, the clock arises dependently, yeah, and of course ultimately you could probably trace that dependence, you know, to all aspects of the universe, but the basis of the label clock is this accumulation of stuff right here. It's not the whole universe that you label clock upon. It's a certain things here that, you know, our mind has put together as one object that we give the label clock to and assign, you know, and it performs a certain function to it. Okay? So the basis of the label is the things that have to be assembled for us to label clock, for example, or to label person. But when we say, what does the clock depend upon, then you can go beyond the basis of the label, because the clock, also the clock has metal in it, it depends on the miner, doesn't it? You know, and it depends on the person, and where was this clock made? Probably China, you know? That the people in the factory and the people who built the factory and the parents of the people who built the factory and
this is the big circle.
Right. But not that big circle is not the basis of the label clock. No.
So there's where it doesn't exist then.
Yeah. Between all the things, all the causes and conditions on which clock depends and the basis of the label clock, they're different. Okay?
So is that how it is different from, say, nihilism?
From what?
Nihilism.
Nihilism. Okay, nihilism means going to the extreme and saying nothing exists. Okay? In other words, people who fall to the extreme of nihilism think that because you can't find something ultimately, when you do the, you know, with ultimate analysis, you examine and you try and find something, they think that because you can't find it with ultimate analysis, that therefore it doesn't exist at all, even on the conventional level. Okay? So that's a misunderstanding. That's an extreme. Saying that because it's ultimately not findable, because you can't draw a circle around it ultimately, that means it doesn't exist at all, even conventionally. Okay? That's a misunderstanding, because when you don't analyze, when you don't use the ultimate analysis to look for what is this thing, Yeah, when you're just satisfied with what appears, then all these things appear and they exist and they function. Okay? So that's why something can be ultimately, it could be empty on the ultimate level and existent on the conventional level. Okay? Yeah. So we often talk about two extremes here. One is that extreme of nihilism, which confuses emptiness of inherent existence with total non-existence. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is saying, well, things exist, therefore they must inherently exist. They must have their own essence. Otherwise, if, you know, people go to the extreme and say, well, if it's just a label, then, you know, you could call this an elephant. And, you know, it would make it an elephant. Well, no, you can't. Calling the basis of label of a clock an elephant won't make it function like an elephant. Okay? So then those people say, well, then there has to be some essence that makes it a clock and not an elephant. So it is truly existent. It is inherently existent. Okay? So those people confuse true existence or inherent existence with plain old conventional existence. And they can't distinguish those two. So the extreme of absolutism confuses regular old existence or conventional existence, because the only kind of existence there is conventional existence. It confuses that with inherent existence and thinking things have their own independent essence unrelated to everything else. That's one extreme of absolutism. The other extreme is nihilism, which confuses total non-existence with being empty of independent existence. And those two things aren't the same. Okay? So when it talks about, you know, avoiding the two extremes, those are the two extremes you want to avoid. And what's the middle way view that we're trying to have to see that things exist, but they're empty? Okay? That things exist on the level of appearances when you don't analyze, but when you do analyze, they evaporate. Can't find something that is them. So they say it's very hard to put those two things together, because as soon as we go on the side of something's appearing, we say, ah, it must inherently exist. And as soon as we go to the side of, well, I can't find it when I examine, then we go, ah, totally non-existent. So we flip-flop. And so they say that finding the middle way view is actually quite difficult.
How do nihilists explain objects then?
Well, how do nihilists explain objects? With great difficulty. Because they say nothing exists. They say it's all a dream. Nothing exists. Okay. Now in Buddhism, we don't say things are a dream. We say they are like a dream. Or we don't say things are illusions, we say they are like illusions. There's a big difference between being an illusion and being like an illusion. Being a dream and being like a dream. Okay? Being a reflection in a face, a reflected face in a mirror and, you know, being a face in a mirror. There's a difference there. Okay? So the idea between being an illusion and being like an illusion, or being a reflection and being like a reflection, is that an illusion is something that does not exist in the way it appears. Okay? So if you take drugs and you have a hallucination of an elephant in the room, there's no elephant in the room. The elephant that you're perceiving does not exist in the way it appears. When you dream, you know, you dream that you went to Peru. Okay? Did you go to Peru? No, your body's here. Okay? But there was an appearance of Peru that didn't exist in the way, you know, you get what I mean? You know, I mean, there's a dream, you know, and things, but it's not a real Peru. You didn't go to real Peru. Okay?
Astral travel.
unraveled. Like,
well, we're not.
So
okay. So I'm talking about dreams and things appearing, you know, that things appear, but they do not exist in the way they appear. Okay? Now, when we say something's a dream, okay, that object isn't really there. There's not a real Peru. It's a dream Peru. Or when you look in the mirror and see a face, there's not a real face in the mirror. It's a reflected face. Okay? So when we say things are like a reflection or like a dream, like an illusion, it means they appear in one way, but they exist in another way. Yeah. But they're different from a dream or a reflection or a hallucination in that the thing exists. Okay? Whereas the Peru in your dream doesn't exist. The face in the mirror doesn't exist. The elephant you hallucinated in the room doesn't exist. Okay? So that's why we say things are like a dream or like an illusion, but we don't say they are an illusion. Because saying they are an illusion would imply that there's nothing really there. But that's not true. There is something there, but what's there is not findable. It's an appearance. Okay? So that's why, for example, you know, when you you dream, and you might have a very good dream or you might have a bad dream, you know, you might dream that, you know, someone marvelous turned up in your life. Yeah, or you might dream that a monster's chasing you. But in either way, there's no monster and there's no marvelous person. It was all a dream. You wake up the next morning, none of that is there. Okay, so you might beat up the monster, yeah, and you might hug the marvelous person, but actually that all happened in a dream and it's not real. Yeah, whereas in real life, if you beat somebody up, you're hurting another sentient being. And if you hug somebody, you know, you're hugging another sentient being. It's not a dream sentient being.
Huh? How can you really tell the difference between a dream and real life?
How can you tell a difference between a dream or real life? Well, I guess you go back to the old thing of pinching yourself, you know. Like we do every night, you know, when you go up, get up to pee in the middle of the night, you're just checking here, you know. Okay.
What about, like, you had dreams, but then a couple years later, you try to remember it, but you kind of mix your memory with your dreams.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think we've all had that experience of we dream something and then we confuse a memory with a dream and stuff. That's just confused mind. Yeah. We get confused about a lot of things. Yeah, we see a movie on TV and we think it really happened. Actually, you know what? Another very good example of this is television. Yeah, you watch a television program, okay? There's somebody you're seeing on television, and you can get quite emotional about the television program. You know, is there somebody in that box on the table? Are there people in that box? No, there's no people in that box. Yeah, there's the appearance of people in that box, but there's no people there. Okay, so they exist in a different way than they appear, because they appear like real people, and we get all emotional. But when we examine, there's no people in that box. Okay, so, you know, making the analogy, it looks like there's inherently existent people, just regularly, but when we examine, there's no inherently existent people. Okay? So people exist in a way, people appear in a different way than they exist. They appear to have their own nature and exist truly and inherently, but that's a false appearance, and they don't exist in that actual way. They exist completely just on the level of appearance. nothing more than that. But even though things aren't inherently existent, we generate a lot of emotions towards them, don't they? When we can see that there's nothing actually there existing in the way it appears, it can calm our emotions down a lot. You had a question?
So would you continue to discuss why emptiness versus... what would be versus emptiness or something conventionally real? Why is that significant? Why should we discuss that?
Okay, so why should we even be talking about this whole topic? That's a very good question. You know, why are we talking about that? Is there a real bottle, water bottle here, or isn't there a real water bottle? Why is that important? Well, because when our minds at the present are very ignorant and, you know, things appear to us to inherently exist and have their own nature, and we grasp at that appearance as being accurate and true, and we think that things and people, ourselves included, actually exist that way. So then we reify everything, we concretize everything, okay? And everything all of a sudden becomes incredibly important. You know, why? Because there's a real me. And, you know, we're not just content with labeling me independence upon a body and mind, but all of a sudden we feel there's a real me. And once there's a real me, that me is really important. You know, more important than anybody else. Yeah. And I like chocolate, and I deserve to have chocolate, and I don't care if it's your chocolate because I want it, you know, and I'm going to take it away from you, and I want to be happy, and your job is to make me happy. And if you get in the way of my happiness, if you take my chocolate away, I'm going to punch you, you know, or drop some bombs on you, or talk about you behind your back, or I'm going to do something, okay? So based on this, you know, solidification, this reification that our ignorance does, then we get very attached to ourself and, by extension, anything that gives us pleasure. And we have a lot of aversion to anything that gets in the way of our pleasure or gives us displeasure. You know, so then we run around trying to grab at everything frantically that we think is going to make us happy, and we can never get everything, or we get something and we're disappointed, and we do all sorts of unethical things to get the things that we think are going to make us happy, and, you know, they disappoint us or we can't get them, and then we get problems instead, and we get angry, and then we do create all sorts of negative actions because we're angry, or we're jealous because somebody else has something better than we do and that's unfair. And how can they have, you know, somebody else has more chocolate than I do. I want more. I deserve more. This is my human right. The universe owes it to me. And then, you know, we drop some bombs on them because we're jealous. Or we drop some bombs on the one who, you know, made them have more, who gave more chocolate to them instead of gave the chocolate to me. You know, and we begin to have a lot of problems, don't we? Okay. Or we get all arrogant. I have more chocolate than the rest of the world. Look at my chocolate piled up here. You know, I mean, I'm using chocolate. I hope you understand that it could mean anything that we're attached to, okay? Our status, our reputation, our sex life, anything, you know. Here it is, you know, my big pile of chocolate. I have more than you. I'm so great, you know. And if you're nice to me, I might give you some. Okay? Then we start manipulating people. Okay? And then we're miserly because even they're nice to us, we don't really want to give them anything. So we take out the stale chocolate or the ones, the kind of chocolate that we don't like so much, and we give it to that person who was nice to us because we don't want to give them the good chocolate that we really like. Okay? So you see, we get involved in all these, you know, difficult situations, And we feel so much unhappiness. We do actions that interfere with other people's happiness. You know, we just create more and more anger, more and more craving. Then at the time, when the time of death comes, forget about dying peacefully. You know, that's the last thing our mind can do because it's so involved with the attachment and the anger. And then we come to die and I'm angry, it's not fair that I die, you know, it's not fair that my younger brother gets to live longer than me, and, you know, I'm protesting that I get to die and it's God's fault, and, you know, how can I die and leave these people? I don't want to leave them, they mean so much to me, they can't live without me, and I don't want to leave my house, and, you know, I don't want to leave my car, and I don't want to leave my trophies, and I don't want to leave my identity. And so we cling at the time of death, and time of death, you know, doesn't matter, you can protest all you want, doesn't matter, we die, you know. So then, you know, death is like, becomes really awful because so much anger, so much clinging. Then, you know, in the process of dying, all those karmic seeds from the negative actions we did to get what we wanted and attack everything we didn't like, then those karmic seeds ripen, you know, and they make our mind attracted to an unfortunate rebirth. And then we have a, you know, an unfortunate rebirth where there's even grosser suffering. Okay? So all of this happens because we misapprehend things. We misconceive how they exist. So that's why this ignorance is the root of our cyclic existence, the root of our problems. And because ignorance grasps at inherent existence, wisdom sees that inherent existence doesn't exist at all. So ignorance and wisdom are completely contradictory. Yeah, once you generate wisdom, the ignorance cannot be manifest in your time at the same time the minute the wisdom is manifest in your mind. And so by gradually, repeatedly developing wisdom, and especially direct perception of the nature of things, then gradually we reduce the ignorance and its seeds until the point when they're totally eliminated. And then that's real freedom. That's real liberation, because then we're no longer controlled by our ignorance, our attachment, our anger, our pride, and jealousy. Then we have real freedom. Okay? So that's why this conversation is important. Yeah? Because, you know, we're trying to really understand what does exist and what doesn't exist. Because if we can realize things as they are and realize emptiness, then that is like the ultimate panacea that calms all of our misery and all of our confusion. Yeah? So wisdom does something that no doctor can ever do. Yeah, that's why it's important. Yeah? Did you want to follow up?
Well, there are times when I'll just say this personally. Mm-hmm. There are times when I can say, look at my three sisters and see the role that they play in life and in my life and in everything, mm-hmm. and really deeply understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm moving myself towards letting go of expectations of them. And then I can say, oh, yes, I really understand them. I understand their role. I understand my role. I am not going to expect anything of them. And, you know, within a half hour, I can hear my feelings.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, see, I believe that I've convinced my brain,
uh-huh.
that there's still something that's tied. There's, and it feels like it's my heart. Now, mm-hmm. you know, I know I'm thinking like an American or whatever, but, you know, brain, heart.
Uh-huh.
But it feels like I have this all arranged. The heart still goes, oh, I want them to like me or something,
yeah.
you know, and feel bad. And so,
yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, so I think everybody can resonate with what she's talking about. You know, you say you can think, oh, my sisters, and I see their role, and I understand them, and I'm not holding anything against them, and it all makes sense. And they're just sentient beings doing the best that they possibly can, and they don't really mean me any harm. And you feel completely peaceful sitting on your meditation, you know, cushion, thinking about this. You dedicate the merit, you get up, the telephone rings, and it's your sister, and you go, why didn't you call me yesterday? And there we are, you know, ticked off again. Yeah, everybody's had that experience. That's because, yeah, it takes a while to really transform what's going on inside of us, because we've held on to the wrong ideas for so long that just intellectually seeing that they're wrong one time is not going to do it. We need to familiarize ourselves with it again and again and again and again, and move the understanding from our head into our heart. Yeah, and that takes time. And so similarly, when we're talking here about emptiness, it's not a thing of intellectually understanding it. We can spout off all sorts of stuff about emptiness and sound like we know what we're talking about and get angry the next minute. And that's because our understanding is just at the level here, and we've got to bring it down into here so that we really eliminate those wrong conceptions that are grasping. Mm-hmm. So it takes time. Yeah, it's not that we failed. We've done good work, and certainly understanding it intellectually is better than we've done before, because at least understanding something intellectually gives us the awareness that it is possible to become, and that things don't really exist in the way that we thought they did. And it lets us know that, oh yeah, it is possible to let go. Yeah, but then we just need to increase that period of letting go from 30 seconds to, you know, much longer. So we need some patience and perseverance. But still, we're making progress. Did you have something, Bobby?
You said a phrase, ignorance grasps at...
Ignorance grasps at inherent existence or true existence. Wisdom sees that inherent or true existence does not exist in the least. Okay? So it's like an analogy would be, wisdom says there's an elephant in this room. I mean, ignorance says there's an... Just checking. No, it took you a while. Ignorance says there's an elephant in this room. Wisdom says, sorry, no, there isn't one. Okay? Yeah.
This is a little bit along the same lines as her question. It has to do with our own personalities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the nature of being passionate or, you know, quick to anger. But, and sometimes when I think about, you know, meditation and everything, I have trouble seeing, you know, where does your personality fit in there to where you still accept yourself, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a passionate person, that implies attachments and mm-hmm. these things, and so mm-hmm. how do you gel?
Okay. Okay, so you're talking about personality, and how do you gel having a personality of being passionate or being quick to temper with all this talk about there's no self in there. Okay? Are we one inherently existent personality? Do you have a solid, concrete personality? Is it sufficient to say, oh, I'm quick to anger right now, therefore it's useless for me to practice the meditations on patience because my personality is an angersome personality?
Can it be a habit?
It's a habit. But is that you? Is it fair to say, oh, that's my personality, therefore I don't need to try? No. Okay, what we call a personality is just an accumulation of habits. But if we look, we can find, for every habit we have, we can also find within ourselves the exact opposite thing. Okay, so we might be quick to anger, but we also have the seed of patience in ourselves right now, too. And we have the seed of being able to be calm. We might have a lot of, you know, passion and clinging, but we also have the seed of just being balanced. Yeah? So we can't say we have one solid personality and that's who we are, because no, we're made up of all sorts of contradictory things. And so our job in spiritual practice is to be able to distinguish, you know, what are beneficial attitudes and emotions that we want to cultivate, what are detrimental ones that lead us to create negative karma and cause suffering. So first discriminate between the two of them, and then set out to apply the antidotes to the ones that cause suffering so that they decrease, and, you know, nourish and fertilize the ones that cause happiness so that they get stronger and remain more stable in our mind. Okay? Yeah?
I think that for a long time I had a misconception that to be in touch with this ultimate reality meant that I didn't care.
Yeah.
Because it's all empty, so therefore it's meaningless. You know, and it's just really recently that I've realized that those are not necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I can still be a passionate person in terms of loving things or.
Yeah.
But that brings me to my question, which I still have some question about getting back to ultimate reality and whatever you call the interim reality or whatever. I can't recall the term that you use.
Conventional
reality.
Yeah.
You know, there are things happening in conventional reality that I care about. Sometimes I really don't like them.
Really? I wonder what you could be talking about.
And, you know, I have this kind of. Now I sort of have like the Buddhist guilty conscience, you know, about, you know, oh God, you know, if I say that, will I be creating suffering? You know, like if I'm against apartheid and if I'm really against apartheid and I say, you know, I'm the city of Berkeley and then however many other cities and countries went along and said, we're so against apartheid, we're not doing business with you and we're ostracizing you or whatever, you know. And you know, I see that, you know, in conventional reality, that along with a bunch of other things led to the end of apartheid, which I see as a positive outcome, you know. But, you know, then there's this whole thing about, well, God, you know, is that too much attachment? And, you know, is that creating suffering? Because it probably creates suffering.
Okay. Yeah. So your question has many different parts here. Yeah, but you started out by saying that, you know, you used to think that by saying everything was empty, it meant that nothing was important. It's like, okay, nothing ultimately exists, so who cares about it? Okay, that is actually going to the extreme of nihilism, because you're thinking it doesn't exist at all. Okay, so if you find that you've become completely uncaring by meditating on emptiness, then your understanding of emptiness is not correct. Okay, because when we meditate on emptiness correctly, then our conviction in cause and effect actually becomes stronger, and our determination to practice ethical discipline becomes stronger, because we see that things are not independent, they are dependent, they arise due to causes and conditions. And karma is talking about causes. So we create causes and those lead to effects. So in actual fact, when our understanding of emptiness is correct, we gain more faith in karma, more faith in ethical discipline, more compassion to beings who are suffering, because we see that their suffering is totally unnecessary, okay, that it's the ignorance causing them suffering. So we have more compassion for them. And then that compassion can motivate us to really do things in the world that can be for the benefit of sentient beings. So like you said, you know, doing things that oppose apartheid and that function, and they can, you know, stop that horrible system. Yeah. So we have to make sure, you know, that our understanding of emptiness is correct, that we're not going to nihilism and saying, oh, nothing matters, because things do matter. Okay, but we need to recognize that they matter, but not get attached to them. Oh, they matter so much, I've got to make this happen, and these guys are my friends, and these are my enemies, and I'm going to make it my way. You know, there you, if you get into that, then you're grasping at inherent existence. Okay?
That's
yeah.
Like, it exists as long as it benefits all beings. I mean, that's part of what I heard. Just, I mean, to feel that passion or that concern,
mm-hmm.
looking at that, not becoming attached to things, but to the benefit of all
right.
around.
Yeah. So, what you're asking is, can you be passionate about benefiting others, but without being attached to it? Yes. And that's what we're aiming for. Okay. So don't think that, you know, you become a Buddhist and all you do is sit on like a bump on a log and don't go, duh, it doesn't matter, duh, it's all empty, duh. You know, that's not it exactly. But, you know, you really see the cause and effect. Do matter, and you have compassion for sentient beings, and so you act out of it for what can bring about benefit. Okay, one last question.
About emptiness and compassion together on the ultimate level.
Are emptiness and compassion together on the ultimate level? Remember, nothing ultimately exists. Emptiness and compassion can definitely be in union. Remember when we were talking yesterday about the method aspect of the path and the wisdom aspect of the path? The method aspect of the path includes compassion and all the actions you do out of compassion. And, you know, by creating good karma or merit, by acting compassionately, you fertilize your mind and you purify your mind and you make it easier to gain a realization of emptiness. And the more you realize emptiness, the more you have accurate compassion for sentient beings, instead of, you know, what do you call it, woo-woo compassion? You know, kind of, no, everybody's suffering so much. when people get into that, the Tibetans have this great story. Some lama must have invented it. And they tell the story of, you know, the carrot. And there's the carrot, and it's growing in the ground, pushing back the ground, trying so hard to grow, and it finally grows. And then some evil human being comes and pulls it out of the ground. You know, chops it up, and the carrot is screaming, ouch, ouch, help, you know. And so they make a big joke about this, you know, because the carrot doesn't have a mind stream. It doesn't experience suffering. But, you know, we can get all woo-woo about a carrot, can't we? Okay, so... yeah, so our wisdom needs, you know, to be accurate, you know. And so our wisdom helps us not to have this kind of, you know, kind of compassion, but to actually see that, yes, suffering exists, but it exists because the causes of it exist. If you eliminate the causes of suffering, suffering it stops. How do you eliminate the causes of suffering? By helping others to realize emptiness and realizing it yourself. Okay?
Time's up.
Okay. Yeah, right. Okay, so let's just sit. Meditate for a couple of minutes. So think about what we said and, you know, think how you can apply this in your own life.